It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We learn about how imposing a new sales tax may influence supply and demand as Milwaukee's Common Council and Mayor approve a 2% sales tax to avoid cuts to city services. Call in with a question or a comment, 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Richard Ochsner is a senior policy associate in the Urban Brookings Tax Policy Center. Work focuses on state and local tax policy, budgets, and other finance issues. Richard, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Good morning, Kate. Thank you so much for having me on.
Good morning. So Milwaukee leaders approved this 2% sales tax increase. Despite concerns, it would hurt local businesses or disproportionately affect low-income residents. Should Milwaukee businesses or residents be concerned about this new tax?
So both of those things have truth to them, but you should also take a step back and think through how these are going to affect people in their day-to-day lives. So let's tackle the business side of this first. Most research shows that consumers generally are not affected by local sales taxes. I know this is new in Milwaukee and there's a huge debate about it, but this is not uncommon. 38 states have local sales taxes. Some of them are quite high across the country. But we find that in general, consumers don't change their behavior too much. And if you think about the cost of the tax, that'll make sense. For example, if you had to run outside tomorrow and buy $100 worth of school supplies or clothing or brewer's gear, you know, you would be paying $2 on that $100 purchase. And is $2 enough to get you to drive outside of the city limits to avoid the tax? Probably not. If it's like a $20 purchase, we're talking only 40 cents. The one place where this does become an issue for consumers and therefore businesses are with high value purchases. Because again, if you're going to spend upwards of $2,000, now it's $40. If it's $20,000, now it's $400. Those are the types of purchases that could give consumers a reason to leave the city and buy something somewhere else.
That extra mileage, that extra gas might be cost effective in that terms. The new tax will only apply to businesses within the city limits. And then we also have Milwaukee County, which is contemplating hiking its sales tax from 0.5% to 0.9%. Along those lines, when you layer on new taxes, are people more likely to change their ways?
So again, we don't really see this in these day-to-day transactions. And, you know, we are talking about, you know, moving to what, it will, as you said, this is correctly for the consumer, it's going to be roughly a 7.5% tax rate. And that is definitely higher. And I don't want to in any way underplay the burden that puts on residents and especially lower income residents. And we'll get back to that in seconds. But again, it's not uncommon. If you look at even neighboring states, you know, when you tally up their combined rates, I think you get rates as high as 7% in Iowa, 7.3% in Minnesota, 6% in Michigan, and close to as high as, I think, 11% in Illinois. This does not, again, tend to have a huge effect on consumer behavior, but it absolutely does create a burden for residents and specifically low-income residents. Everyone pays the same tax rate. Everyone pays 7.5% when they go to purchase something. But if you think of someone who earns, you know, $100,000 or even $1 million, they're going to save a lot of their income. They're not going to spend it all. But if you think of someone earning $20,000, $10,000 or less than that, they're going to be spending nearly all of their money on consumption because they have to. And that is why the sales tax is regressive, because a lower income household is spending nearly every dollar they earn. That is getting taxed. And so the tax is a larger share of their income than for a higher income person.
There's been some sentiment from the city officials saying, look, we need to talk with our constituents who are low income before we take additional steps here. What about having those conversations? What might come up?
Oh, that's tough. I think the challenge for any government when they're trying to raise a tax is communicating the other side of this. Because we raise revenue to pay for services. And so it's important for the city of Milwaukee to explain why this revenue is needed. Because oftentimes while, you know, tax increases, or specifically a sales tax increase, could place a burden on lower income households, they're often the ones that benefit from the city and county services, and therefore would also be harmed if the tax increase did not go into effect and spending had to be cut. And so there needs to be an honest and transparent conversation about why the decision was made, the trade-offs, and hopefully why the, you know, residents are also benefiting from what this money is doing for them.
We're talking about possible impacts of Milwaukee's new 2% sales tax with Richard Oxshire, who is a senior policy associate in the Urban Brookings Tax Policy Center. You can join in with your questions and your comments about taxation. The number to join in is 800-642-1234. Richard, most of the revenue from a city of Milwaukee sales tax, it has to be spent on the city employee pensions and then also the remainder on police and fire jobs. Does a tax purpose, especially if it's for very specific things, does that have any bearing on consumers?
On consumers, I'm not so sure, but it does help politicians to explain clearly who this is going to. And something to always keep in mind when we talk about, you know, I think sometimes you think like, you know, government spending and you have this vague idea that it's just going somewhere or going to things. State and local spending is almost always for people. You mentioned like police and firefighters. A lot of Milwaukee's money goes to paying for police officers, goes to paying for firefighters and paying for the pensions that help bring in talented public servants who want to work in the area and serve the community. You'll often see politicians explicitly link, you know, one tax to a spending category that has its pros and cons. But for like a city like Milwaukee, it does limited things. For example, I don't believe it spends on education necessarily. So that makes it very easy to say where this money is going, why the money is needed, and why we're going to put it to good use.
Would there be specific types of retail stores in Milwaukee that would be more likely to feel the sting from this new tax?
So businesses, you'll be shocked to learn, do not like tax increases, and will generally object to them. That said, in prior experience, if you're a corner store, if you're, you know, a clothing retailer, again, if you're selling things or day-to-day products, adding a 2% sales tax is probably not going to make the difference between what people are buying and what they're not. It's going to be those high-end retailers who are selling really, really expensive products, because if you're spending thousands of dollars, now the tax becomes an equation. However, there is an inverse here, because we're talking about people who are in Milwaukee who are leaving possibly for the tax. But keep in mind, a lot of people travel to Milwaukee to go out at night, to go shopping.
See a Bucks
And
game.
yes, exactly. And you come into the city and you spend money. And something, you know, and tax nerds call it tax exporting. Because what when you use a sales tax, it allows you to place some of your burden onto non-residents who visit the city. If you contrast that with Milwaukee's current main revenue source, property tax, that's entirely paid by residents. So one advantage of the sales tax is all the people who come into Milwaukee and use its services and benefit from everything it has to do, its vibrancy, its fun, they will now be contributing to the city's tax revenue.
Senior Policy Associate at the Urban Brookings Tax Policy Center, Richard Oxshire, with us examining the local effects of sales tax increases. And you can be part of the conversation about taxation. Call in with a question, share your comment at 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. We dig into the business and consumer implications as Milwaukee approves a 2% sales tax to avoid bankruptcy. And Richard Oxshire is here, senior policy associate at the Urban Brookings Tax Policy Center. You can be part of the conversation, your thoughts. The number to ask a question or share your perspective is 800-642-1234. Let's bring in Nancy in Milwaukee. Hi, Nancy. What would you like to share?
I'd like to say that I am very angry. I live here in the city of Milwaukee, and at one time, all city elected officials and all city employees had to live within the city limits. That law was changed about 6 or 7 years ago, and when it was changed, many city employees and many city elected officials moved out of the city, and I'd like that law put back into effect again, because when I pay my property taxes here in the city, my property taxes are going to pay the pensions of my councilmen, the mayor, and many other elected and officials and many city employees. And I want their tax dollars to be spent here in the city. I don't happen to know where my city councilman lives, but if he by chance lives out in Brookfield or up in Grafton, that means that when he puts gas in his car or gets a haircut and buys groceries and does all of his shopping in Brookfield or Grafton, his tax dollars are going into the pensions of Brookfield elected officials. But my tax dollars are paying the councilman's pension. And I want all of these elected officials and city employees to be forced to move back into the city.
Nancy, thank you for sharing your sentiment. Richard, what do you make of it?
I think Nancy is a good example of what happens when you ask for a tax increase, is that you better be prepared to explain where it's going and why you're doing it. And so, you know, it's not uncommon for residents to want their city officials to live in the city. And as I said, most state and local spending is for officials, including firefighters and police officers, but as well as government officials. They're going to want to see results from that tax increase and see that their tax dollars are being spent the way they want them to be spent.
The IRS and many economists consider sales taxes to be regressive. You mentioned it earlier. Why are sales taxes regressive?
Right. Now, again, regressive is a fancy term that basically says lower income people pay a higher burden than high income people. Now, this can get confusing, but just to be clear, everyone pays the same sales tax rate. So no matter, you know, how much money you're spending, we all pay the same percentage. So that's equal. And in fact, high income residents are typically going to spend more money than low income residents. So in total, they will spend more. Mm. But it's regressive, again, because it's a larger share. It's a larger share of their income. And this, again, speaks to low-income residents have to spend all their income. They can't save it. They got to go out and purchase clothing and food and rent, all these kind of things. And so because a larger share of their income goes towards spending, a larger share of their income goes toward the sales tax than for a higher-income person. So it places a bigger burden on them.
Let's bring in Jeff in Delafield. Jeff, hi, go ahead.
Yes, good morning. I just wanted to say I think this is a terrible blow to the retailers in the city of Milwaukee. And just as an example, I'm looking at buying a professional camera, a very expensive multi-$1,000 camera and equipment. And the retailer I wanted to use is in Milwaukee, and I'm not going to do that. I'm going to go to the Fox Valley or elsewhere. And that's just one example of how people that have the choice are, they're forced to go elsewhere because that's a major chunk of money on a large purchase like that. And that's just an example of how devastating this is going to be to the retailers in the city of Milwaukee. And that's my comment. Thank you.
Jeff, thank you. Richard, case in point to what you said.
Right. And again, I think it's important that Jeff was talking about making a high cost purchase. You are going to see consumers think about this when they do this. And I think, you know, if you talk to politicians, maybe talk to them off the record, they would explain, or even on record, you know, what they'd really like to do is make sure increase rates everywhere so you wouldn't have these disparities. But that's just, it happens because different cities and different localities, little different governments have different spending needs. So they need different amounts of tax revenue. So they have to increase taxes at different levels. A big thing that would help is if the state government played a role and helped out and smoothed things out. But again, there's always these trade-offs between levels of government and what they need to do. And so this is why this is not uncommon to see what is happening in Milwaukee and other governments across the country.
What do you mean by that? How could state government smooth things out?
So just generally speaking, the more the state transfers to local governments, the less they need to raise their own revenue. Now, to be perfectly clear, Wisconsin, the state, gives a lot of money to the city of Milwaukee. I think they account for roughly, you know, a third to almost half, depending on the year, of its revenue. So they're already contributing a, you know, a good chunk of that money. But the more the state can do, because the state's bigger, the more that tax burden is spread across, and you don't see these kind of like cliffs where in one place it's, you know, a very low or no tax, in one place it's a high tax, that would create that consumer choice.
How much do sales tax holidays, which we often see with the start of the school year, how do they benefit low-income families or not?
So, okay, if you asked a politician, they would say that this is the best thing you could possibly do, and it helps everyone out, and it's great. But you were talking to a tax nerd, and as a tax nerd, I must tell you that they don't really benefit consumers. That is because businesses know the tax holiday is coming. And so a business could, for example, just tweak its prices just a little bit to capture all the benefit. And again, we're talking in Milwaukee, you know, it's a 2% tax. And even like, you know, if you, the combined rate is closer to 7%. And so like, would you know if the business was changing its prices by just a couple of dollars? You know, you notice it when it's on your receipt. Would you notice it when you're shopping in advance? So typically we also just get shifts in spending. So let's say that there is a big saving opportunity for consumers. Well, the type of consumers that will benefit are high income residents who can say, you know what, I don't need to spend money now. I'm going to wait to spend money when we have that holiday. Your low income residents typically can't make that delay. They need to buy things again to keep up their home. And so they're not going to benefit. So sales tax holidays, if you can't notice, I'm not really a big fan.
Not a fan.
Not a fan. Not great for consumers. And if they're good for anyone, they're good for high-income consumers, not low-income consumers.
We have a self-proclaimed tax nerd, Richard Oxshire, Senior Policy Associate in the Urban Brookings Tax Policy Center. Let's go to Charlotte in Milwaukee. Charlotte, hi.
Hello. Hello. Oh, my gosh. I have several things now. But I just want to say, I don't know. I know when we use the dump, and we don't live in Milwaukee, we have to pay. You know what I mean? When we go to Milwaukee to the zoo, and you don't live in Milwaukee, you have to pay. Is there any way that if we use the Bucks or the Brewers or the hockey or anything like that, do we pay more? You know what I mean? If we're not living in Milwaukee?
Capturing some of these fees and services from people who live outside Milwaukee using them. Richard, your insights?
So specifically on sports, occasionally you will see special sales taxes tied to like sports teams to capture that activity. You wouldn't do it with a sales tax because, again, the benefit of sales tax is that it's the same. It's simple. You want to make it as broad as possible to try and tamp down some of this consumer choice and you know, decision making. However, you could do this by, for example, levying higher taxes on, say, hotel rentals, because that's going to be people coming from outside. Restaurants, that's both residents, but a lot of non-residents going to come in. Parking, that's going to be both, but again, mostly getting a lot of people from outside. The downs, you know, the upside of that is you're capturing a lot of money from non-residents. The downside is you're possibly, again, putting pressure on those businesses. And these are the businesses that just struggled through COVID. And so you have to kind of weigh, well, we want to get money from non-residents, but we also want to make sure that these businesses are thriving and creating the type of communities that we want.
You've seen those headlines that these sales taxes are supposed to avert a fiscal cliff, avert a bankruptcy. What types of tax reform could Wisconsin enact to help Milwaukee get its finances in order?
Oh, that is a really tough question that I don't know I can answer quickly. I will say that something the state could do, the state of Wisconsin, is the state could look into expanding its refundable tax credits. We talked about the sales tax as regressive and it puts a lower burden, but it's also a really good revenue generator. That's why it makes sense for Milwaukee. What the state could do is, you know, increase and expand its refundable earned income tax credit, which goes to low-income workers, or say create a refundable child tax credit, which goes to families with children, because those benefits would be targeted at low-income residents. Milwaukee can't pass out hand tax cuts. They need the tax revenue. But maybe the state can. The state, in fact, is in the process of cutting taxes. And if it targets those tax cuts at low-income families, that is how you could offset some of the new burden that's been placed on your lower-income residents in Milwaukee.
Well, Richard, thank you so much for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thank you so much, Kate. It's a pleasure.
Richard Oxer is a senior policy associate in the Urbans Brookings Tax Policy Center. And if you would like to peruse our other segments, you can go to our website, WPR.org/morning. Check out our program page to find conversations from the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network. It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Nationally, 100,000 childcare workers have left the field since the start of the pandemic. That's contributed to a growing crisis for parents and daycare providers. But early childhood education programs at Wisconsin's technical colleges are thriving. Jenny Peek reports that may be because state support for childcare is focused on scholarships instead of boosting wages.
It's lunchtime at Red Caboose in Madison, and Morgan Cutler is helping 11-month-old Cassie with her meal. Like most days in the toddler room, more ends up on the floor and on Cutler than anywhere else. Cutler's worked at the Child Care Center since 2018, when she was working on a degree at Madison College.
I actually did my practicums here at Caboose when I was getting a tour done of the building. I was in the 3-year-old room. So a child came up and sat in my lap, and that solidified me, like, yeah, this is the right place for me.
But her family worries about her future in a job with staggeringly low pay. They've even pushed her to consider a more lucrative career.
I don't care if the pay is better. What I care about is, do I feel comfortable?
But low wages have pushed many childcare workers out, making it all the more surprising that the state's tech schools with early childhood education programs are stable, if not growing.
Last year, we saw a 10% increase in enrollment over the year before. Now, we're not to pre-pandemic levels yet, but that does tell me that we are going in the right direction.
That's Katie Pedersen. She's a director for the Wisconsin Technical College System. She says part of that success has to do with robust state funding for students who get degrees in early childhood education. More than 10,000 Wisconsin early childhood education students have gotten state scholarships since 1999. Jessica Chochi is a dean at Madison College. She calls the scholarship program a game changer.
I think our full-time equivalency has increased 40% this year because we've been able to award these scholarships to help students move through our program.
But a survey by the National Association for the Education of Young Children found 32% of the state's child care workers are considering leaving their jobs. They tie that to low wages and burnout. Nationally, federal data shows child care workers make an average of just $14 per hour.
That makes it really hard for people to want to get into the field. Regardless of your passions, you still have to eat.
That's Annie Tripp. They're finishing a degree in early childhood education at Madison College after 18 years in the field. They recently took an executive director job at a child care center, but that decision came after a months-long break from the work to consider other options.
When you put it all together with the emotional, the mental, the physical, I mean, the amount of physical labor that goes into this work, it's so severely undervalued by our society.
Federal pandemic relief boosted child care worker salaries and helped keep some centers afloat, but those funds are set to run out in early 2024. Democratic Governor Tony Evers proposed extending that support in the new state budget, but the Republican-controlled legislature removed it from the legislation. Madison College's Jessica Chochi says low wages are a hard truth in the industry.
Our students choose this because they care deeply about children. Our hope is that we help them find employment that meets their own financial needs and their own professional needs. But we are honest about the fact that the wages in childcare are incredibly challenging.
Back at Red Caboose, Morgan Cutler is helping the kids settle down for nap with some books.
Grandma, what do you see?
It's these little moments that help keep her in the career.
I love being at Red Caboose. I will never leave.
Right now, she says what childcare workers need most is help or an extra set of arms.
Just so I can, you know, give this child a hug or separate these children when they're having a hard time. It's an amazing field. A lot of people don't appreciate it, but we need more people.
But without an increase in wages, it's hard to say when or if the industry will find more workers. Jenny Peek, Wisconsin Public Radio.
It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. As communities across Wisconsin grapple with pollution from toxic PFAS chemicals, new federal study finds close to half of the country's tap water may be contaminated with harmful forever chemicals. Call in along the way. Your questions and comments are welcome at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Sydney Evans is senior science analyst at the Environmental Working Group. That's a nonprofit focused on issues relating to the environment. Sydney, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me.
Well, let's unpack the new research from the USGS, the U.S. Geological Survey, finding at least 45% of U.S. tap water contains some type of harmful forever chemicals. What are your major takeaways from this federal research?
This is something that EWG has been working on for a long time, and it's really great to see a study like this would just happen and then also get so much attention as well and get so much, you know, of public interest, because there were samples taken across the country trying to figure out where this PFAS pollution is. It's something that EWG has been saying for a long time, likely impacts tens to hundreds of millions of people, because once these chemicals are in the environment, they're fully synthetic, they basically never break down, hence the name forever chemicals, and they're toxic at really, really low concentrations over time.
USGS finding PFAS concentrations similar between public water systems and private wells. What does that indicate?
That just goes to show how widespread this issue is. I mean, when you look at tap water contaminants across the country, which is basically what I specialize in, a lot of times you see different signatures, right? The either groundwater or surface water, private wells, they've all kind of got their own issues. But it just goes to show how ubiquitous and pervasive it is that these chemicals are popping up everywhere, because once they're in the environment, they just tend to spread around.
What did the USGS find from wells sampled in Wisconsin?
So there was only a handful of samples. I dug into the data a little bit. It looks like it was mostly focused on the kind of western border, likely to reflect, you know, they were just getting a sample from across the United States and Wisconsin as well. They were trying to get something representative of the overall population with a, you know, relatively small number of samples, considering the number of private wells and utilities across the country. But it aligns pretty well because EWG has also put out some work, right? So we have done some testing across the country, pretty limited, but we've also maintained a map of all of the public data of PFAS that's been put out there. There's a handful concentrated in Wisconsin. And then we also have an industrial map that just kind of goes to show all of the blanks. I think that's the biggest takeaway from this, is that the USGS study and estimate was very valuable, but it's still an estimate. What we're really looking forward to at EWG is the upcoming UCMR testing by EPA, which will get much larger numbers of samples across the country from basically all utilities serving more than 3,000 people, and then also a bunch of smaller utilities in more rural areas as well. And so that, I think, is what's ultimately going to highlight just how bad this pollution is.
Can you explain a little bit about what that means, UCMR, and how EPA will undertake such a process of testing?
Yeah, UCMR stands for the Unregulated Contaminant Monitoring Rule, because although we know that PFAS is toxic at low concentrations. There's a lot of studies that back that up. It is still unregulated in drinking water. There are quite a number of contaminants that are actually unregulated in drinking water, are present in drinking water, but known to cause health harms. And PFAS is one of those. Now, luckily, there is a proposed maximum contaminant level that is scheduled to be finalized sometime at the end of next year. But in the meantime, this is perfectly legal for PFAS to be in tap water. The utilities don't have to monitor for it. They don't have to treat for it. But UCMR and these programs, these unregulated contaminant monitoring rule testing programs, are so important for establishing these protections and regulations. That's what's really going to show how widespread the issue is and how badly this treatment and protection is needed.
I wonder, how would the Environmental Working Group, the EWG, characterize the federal government's response to PFAS contamination in drinking water so far? What would you say?
Sure, that's a good question, because I think slow would be the word that I would use, because PFAS has been a problem for decades. This is, has not been a secret, maybe against the industry's wishes, but all the industries that use PFAS in their products and their industrial processes. But this has been an ongoing issue for actual decades. You know, these chemicals were originally developed and used in, I think, the 40s and 50s originally for things like making the nonstick coatings like Teflon or like Scotchgard. And they started popping up in water shortly after that. And it's just been this slow movement of, you know, groups like EWG and other advocacy groups trying to put this information out there and draw attention to how bad and how widespread this is. And it's just been really slow, but it is so exciting. I don't think I can really express how big of a moment it was when there was finally that proposed MCL, because the EPA has not regulated a new contaminant in drinking water for decades. Even though we have a lot of evidence that there are contaminants out there that are in drinking water and that cause health harms over time, there hasn't been a new regulation. So the fact that we're getting one and that we're getting a fairly stringent regulation for PFAS is a huge step in the right direction. It's certainly not the end. There's a lot more work to be done on PFAS, but it's, I guess,
a big
that
milestone.
Sums it up.
Okay. Yeah. Yes. So, well, I hear you saying the word slow. The EPA proposing the safety standard of 4 parts per trillion for 2 of the most widely studied types of PFAS chemicals in drinking water. And here in Wisconsin, some samples reached more than 40 times higher than that standard. When might the EPA's proposed standard be adopted?
That's the big question, right? So even though these standards are pretty low, it's 4 parts per trillion for those two, and then there's also a regulated group for a hazard index. But the right now, that MCL is just proposed, and it's not scheduled to be finalized until, I think, September of next year. And then once that happens, right, that won't make a real impact on tap water for years to come, because all of this new treatment is going to have to be installed at systems across the country to get into compliance, all of the extra testing that's going to have to be done. It's going to take years. It's going to take years.
The Environmental Working Group's senior science analyst, Sydney Evans, with us, is explaining this new research comparing home water filters, how they stand up to PFAS contamination in tap water. Call in at any point to ask a question, 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It's The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The nonprofit Environmental Working Group, EWG, they test 10 different types of water filters to see how well they remove toxic PFAS chemicals. You can call in with a question about water filtration at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Sydney Evans is a senior science analyst at the Environmental Working Group. So, Sydney, 10 different types of filters for the newest filter guide from EWG. They run from around $30 to nearly $350. Why test these particular filters?
Yeah, that's a great question. So we wanted to look at countertop pitcher filters specifically. We know that reverse osmosis systems are pretty much the best option for reducing PFAS in home tap water, but they're not accessible to everyone. They have to be plumbed in. They're very expensive. So looking at pitcher filters was, we wanted to fill that gap. And including this, you know, we could only test so many filters. So we chose some big household name brands like Brita and Pure. But then we also wanted to look at some more like niche filters that had claims of specialized media or that had additional contaminant, you know, reduction claims. And so we came up with this 10 to really run the gamut of, you know, the cheapest, most widely available filters to some that were maybe a little more expensive, a little more niche, that had a chance to reduce some of these chemicals.
And so this is a category of gravity-based water filters. Can you explain the gravity and just kind of the filter approach here?
Yeah. So all of these were either pitchers or dispensers that sit on the countertop. Mm-hmm. So they have an upper reservoir that has a filter unit inserted into it. And as the water flows down just through gravity, no pumps or anything crazy, into the bottom of the pitcher, it's going to be filtered. And then, of course, you can either open the little tab to dispense it or pour it out of the pitcher and you have your filtered water.
Well, take us into your bench science. How did you carry out this experiment?
So we wanted to get a sense of how these filters were going to perform in real world conditions. We wanted to see how they stacked up when they were filtering water from a regular old home tap that was contaminated by PFAS. Because there's a lot of other things in tap water that can potentially impact the filter's efficacy, right? Like the water hardness, other contaminants present. So for each of these filters, we ran 10 gallons of that tap water through the filter to give it a chance to do its thing. Maybe, you know, start filling up the filter with contaminants because they're all trapped inside this filter, which is why it's so important to maintain them and change them out. And then after that, we took a sample of the unfiltered tap, filtered one last gallon through all of the filters, and then took samples to compare, you know, how much PFAS there was in all of the filtered samples versus the unfiltered tap to kind of come up with a percent reduction for the total PFAS.
And what type of range did you find in the results?
It was pretty wide. And honestly, I was very surprised at the results. I was thinking, you know, these filters can only do so much. They're probably going to have fairly similar results, but there was a wide spread. I think it was anything from just 20% reduction all the way up to 100% where we could not detect PFAS in the filtered samples.
What about filtering water multiple times? Some people use water that has a filter through their fridge. Would you recommend then running it through one of these specialized filters that is going to really target PFAS?
That's a really good question. It's not something that we looked at for this study, mm-hmm. but I would anticipate that, you know, because there were in many of these filters, there was just a percent reduction, right? That maybe filtering it multiple times, you know, could have some kind of impact. It could maybe reduce the concentrations a little bit more, but I really don't know. And frankly, it might be, you know, that's why we wanted to put this guide out is so that people don't have to worry about filtering their water multiple times. They just know which filters are going to be the best from the get-go.
When you think of that, you know, the class of chemicals, I mean, PFAS, there are like what, 12,000 now types or, you know,
yes.
around there. I mean, can a filter target and remove so many different chemicals?
Yeah, one of the biggest challenges with PFAS is that there's the estimated thousands of chemicals out there, and yet labs can only test for so many. I mean, the last time that EWG, I think, did a large panel of testing, we were talking about 70, 70, not,
wow.
not 7,000, not 700, 70. But we expect that those are going to be at least a decent marker for overall PFAS, right? Mm. And just because there are 12,000 of these chemicals out there in the environment, it doesn't mean that they're all necessarily in your tap water. For example, in our tests, you know, we had a panel to test for about 25 PFAS, and yet in the tap water, we only detected about 10 in the unfiltered tap water. So they're not always out there. And then we expect, because these class of chemicals are fairly similar, which makes them, you know, they have similar properties, they have similar issues with the health risks and how long it, you know, they can stay in the environment. But we expect that the treatment that is effective for, you know, the detectable, the testable PFAS is also going to be fairly effective for the ones that we can't detect. Now, that's not to say we shouldn't stop trying. There definitely needs to be more development and more control on these chemicals. This is not the fix. This is the cleanup, right? We need to look at where the PFAS is coming from, how it's getting into the environment. But I would say that, you know, this is the best option we have, and there's pretty good evidence for these filters that this is effective.
Sydney Evans with us, Senior Science Analyst at the Environmental Working Group. A line into the conversation, 800-642-1234. Sydney, a brand perhaps a lot of people know, Brita pitcher filters, your testing finds reduced just 66% of PFAS in water. Their Elite filter reducing PFAS by just 22%. What factors then lead some filters to do better than others?
That's also a great question. I'm really glad we're getting to dig into some of the work behind this study. So some of these filters have, they're simple, just granular activated carbon. And then others have maybe more stages of filtration. They have different systems. For example, one of the other filters we tested is actually ion exchange. It's not granular activated carbon. And those, all of those technologies, different medias, kind of perfecting this over time. I wasn't sure if it was just a marketing claim or if there was actually going to be some difference. But our study shows that some of these, you know, the makeup of these filters does matter. It does impact how effective these filters are. For the Brita specifically, that was really surprising to me that the two filters, the Elite and the Standard, which is, to my knowledge, in the research that we did, it was supposed to be a matter of the lifetime of the filter. So the Elite was supposed to last longer than the Standard.
Okay.
But what we think happened with the Elite, since it was so much lower, was actually not an issue with the filter media, but actually a poor fit. We had some issues with the filters, you know, either being loose or popping out. So we think maybe some unfiltered water was leaking around the filter into the housing with the filtered water. So that just goes to show that more goes into it than just the filter media. You have to make sure that you're maintaining and setting up these filters properly.
Really quick, because we're out of time here. Is there a third party certification to look for to be assured these systems do what they advertise?
So there are for some contaminants, there are some standards. There's NSF and WQA. Those can both certify filters to actually stand up to the claims that they're making. But you got to be specific. You have to look at exactly what they're being certified for.
Sydney, thank you for joining us.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me.
Sydney Evans is a senior science analyst at the Environmental Working Group, and we have a link to their study on water filters. You can find it at wpr.org/mornings. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network.